Now, in our passage that was just read for us, we have two very different leaders. We have Absalom and we have David. Now, both of these characters have massive character flaws. We've been looking at those over the last couple of weeks. But there is something that splits these two very flawed leaders. There's a particular attribute in this passage that King David has that makes him a good leader in God's eyes, as opposed to Absalom, who is a bad leader. And David is a good leader in spite of his flaws. While he's not perfect, he has something that makes him the kind of person that God wants to work through powerfully for his kingdom. And as your sermon outline shows, I've got 4 points to help us figure out what this is. So we're going to begin by looking at the flaws of these two men, two in particular. So I've titled the first one, David's Weakness, and the second, Absalom's Pride. We're then going to look at the thing that sets David apart from Absalom. And I've titled this, David's Humility. But we're then going to conclude by seeing how it is that David gets this quality. And I've titled this David's Strength. And if we can understand where David gets his strength from, then it will help us become the kind of person, albeit a flawed person, but the kind of person that God actually wants to work through powerfully for his kingdom. And I pray that's something we all want. So let's look at David's weakness, Absalom's pride, David's humility, and David's strength, so that we too can hopefully become the kind of people that God wants to use. Now, even though we only had one chapter read to us, we're actually covering several chapters of 2 Samuel today, from 14 to up to 19, and it's all about how Absalom tries to usurp, but ultimately fail, to take the kingdom away from David. Now, when we left Absalom last week in 2 Samuel 13, Absalom was in exile in Geshur following the murder of his brother Amnon. And as James pointed out last week, the murder of Amnon stemmed basically from David being a terrible father. You see, the reason Amnon treated his half-sister Tamar as nothing more than a sex object is because that's how David treated women. We believe he had somewhere between 20 to 30 wives and concubines. I don't need to tell you that it's very hard to have a meaningful relationship with that many women. They were not there for a relationship for him. They were objects. The reason Absalom went and killed his brother Amnon probably has a great deal to do with that's how David treated his enemies, I should call them in inverted commas as well, such as Uriah. That's how he treated Uriah. He was a bad role model. But here's the thing. Just as bad for David is that he never disciplined his children. That's the other reason he was a bad father. I mean, how do you watch your daughter get raped by your son and do nothing? Right? This was David's big weakness in his life. I want to read to you a verse from the book of 1 Kings. So 1 Kings comes right after 2 Samuel. This passage, it comes at the end of David's life, right? He's about to die, and they're trying to figure out who is going to be his successor. See if this sounds familiar. So Adonijah is David's son, another one of David's sons. Now Adonijah, whose mother was Haggith, put himself forward and said, "I will be king." So he got chariots and horses ready with 50 men to run ahead of him. Sound familiar? His father had never intervened with him by asking, "Why do you behave as you do?" He was also very handsome and the next born after Absalom. See, what this passage makes clear, that is only sort of hinted at in 2 Samuel, is that David's parental pattern is what is known today as permissive parenting. There are four commonly recognized forms of parenting today. So there's authoritarian, authoritative, permissive, and uninvolved. Now, uninvolved is just like it sounds, right? You have very little to do with your kids. It is by far the worst parenting style, and it leads to very unhappy, very unsuccessful kids with major behavioral issues. But here's the thing. Permissive parenting is not far behind that, right? Permissive parenting, no boundaries. I'm just going to let my kids do whatever they want. The problem with that is that these kids have low self-esteem issues and behavioral issues. Authoritarian is better than these two. Authoritarian lays down and enforces boundaries, but the problem is those boundaries are not explained. It's just do what I say, not what I do, and I don't need to explain myself. And kids of these kinds of parental relationships often grow up resentful of their parents and others, and they don't think their opinions are valued. The best parenting style is what's called authoritative. Authoritative parents lay out boundaries, and they enforce those boundaries, but they explain those boundaries to the kids. And all the research shows that children of authoritarian parents grow up to be happy, well-adjusted, and responsible adults who actually feel comfortable expressing their own opinions to others. They have a good amount of assertiveness. That was not David. Right, having children to over two dozen wives and concubines leads us to think that he probably was an uninvolved parent, but at absolute best, according to the 1 Kings passage, he was a permissive parent. He just let his kids run riot. Now the reason, we heard this last week, the reason David didn't pull his kids in a line is probably, we don't know for sure, but it's probably because he felt a little hypocritical. You know, how can I scold my kids for adultery and murder when I did the exact same thing just two chapters before? But here's the thing, that's no excuse. We could come up with a dozen excuses as to why not to discipline our kids. But we do them a disservice when we do. Kids need boundaries. They need them explained and they need them enforced. Please do not follow David's example, because his weakness with his kids actually brought his kingdom down. So let's have a look at that now. Chapter 15. So like I said, we left Absalom in exile last week. In 2 Samuel 14, Joab, the commander of David's army, decided to bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. He thought it was a good idea at the time. Little did he know how disastrous it would be. For we read in 2 Samuel 15, verse 1, "In the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him." Now, the only reason someone would do this is to show off, to set themselves up as someone important. Okay, someone great. But this showing off has a more sinister motive, as we read in verse 2. He would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. Whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, "What town are you from?" He would answer, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your claims are valid and proper, but there is no representative of the king to hear you." And we learn of the end game Absalom has here down in verse 6. "Absalom behaved in this way towards all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice, and so he stole the hearts of the people of Israel." What's Absalom doing here? He's building a support base so that he can take the kingship by force. All right, phase one was to get people on his side. Phase two of the plan is to go to Hebron. Now, Hebron was his hometown, but it was also, incidentally, where David was crowned king. All right, that's where kings get crowned. So he's gone to Hebron with a big entourage. And then we read in verse 10, "Then Absalom sent secret messages throughout the tribes of Israel to say, 'As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron.'" Now, it's just interesting to contrast how Absalom gets the kingship with how David gets the kingship. You see, David had various opportunities to take the kingship by force. Saul was put into his hands. He could have killed Saul on numerous occasions, but he decided not to take matters into his own hands. Rather, David waited 15 long years for God's plan to unfold. The reason being, David was not interested in grasping power for himself. David was actually interested in serving. This is what Jesus says about leadership. Mark chapter 10. "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. See, Jesus said, a good leader is not someone who wants power for themselves. Right? A good leader is someone who wants to serve. That's why we call our parliamentarians ministers. The word minister literally means servant. Absalom's problem was he only cared about himself, grasping power for himself so he could get what he wanted. Another word for that is pride. His 4 years of planning was all so that he could grasp power for himself. And Jesus says, not so with you. And it wasn't so with David. Although David is flawed, we've seen his flaws, we've seen his weaknesses, that doesn't mean that he's not a good leader. And the thing that makes David a good leader overall, with his flaws, is that he cares about others. And that's all he's doing in this passage, really. Have a look at it in verse 13. A messenger came and told David, the hearts of the people of Israel are with Absalom. Then David said to all his officials who were with him in Jerusalem, come, we must flee, or none of us will escape from Absalom. We must leave immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin on us and put the city to the sword. All right, David knows exactly the kind of man Absalom is. He is a man of blood. And so David moves to protect his people. Anyone he thinks is in danger, he gets out of the city, all his officials, right? Now, he does make a mistake by leaving 10 of his concubines behind. We think he left them behind because he didn't think anything bad would happen to them, and he was hoping that they could look after the house, like his household, his palace, until he returned, all right? As it turns out, though, these poor concubines also get used as sex objects by Absalom in the following chapter. I suggest you read all the way up to chapter 19 this week to see how it actually unfolds. But we believe David did not expect that to happen. That was just an unfortunate thing that happened. But what he's doing here is he's looking after the people who are supporting him. And he even does it with foreigners. So have a look at verse 19 over the page. Then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, so he's a foreigner, right? Why should you come along with us? Go back and stay with King Absalom. You're a foreigner, an exile from your own homeland. You came only yesterday, and today shall I make you wander about with us? Then what does he say down the bottom? May the Lord show you kindness and faithfulness. Now here's the thing. This is part of his army. He's got a massive chunk of soldiers here that would come in handy. But he doesn't care about that. He just cares about their well-being. And so he says, look, Absalom's not going to do anything to you. You're foreigners. Just go back and just stay in peace and harmony in Jerusalem. That's what David is doing here. He cares about others. And that's what sets him apart. I read a book this year while I was on holidays. I read a couple of books. But this is one of the ones I read. And it talks about what David's doing here. In a way. It's called Captain Class. It's written by Sam Walker. Now, what Sam Walker does in this book is he wants to find out if there is a unifying secret behind the world's greatest sporting teams. And so he just gets all the sporting teams from the last 150 years and he lines them up and he whittles them down to find the ones that just blitzed the world. What are the ones that were the greatest sporting teams in history? And he whittles them down to just 16 teams. Right, 16 teams that just blitzed the world for 3 or 4 years. And then he says, well, what is it about these teams that made them so unbelievably successful? And what he concludes is, it was not money. Right? If money was the key to having a good sporting team, then Manchester United and the New York Yankees would be blitzing the world for the last 100 years. All right? They've got all the money. It's not having a killer coach. Because a lot of these teams that blitzed the world didn't have a killer coach. And it's not having a star player either. Bradman's Invincibles did not make the cut. Michael Jordan's Bulls did not make the cut. Right? He said the one thing that all these 16 teams had was one player who pulled the team together. It was a captain class player. Now, this one player usually went on to become captain, but what he found was these teams started winning as soon as this player arrived, and they stopped winning as soon as that player left. It's Fascinating, isn't it? Now, why am I telling you about this? It's because he then said, well, what are the characteristics that these captain class players had? And he came up with seven. And the third one, get this, was humility. Every single one of these players had humility. And what he meant by humility was they served the team. Now, these captain class players had really poor stats in terms of scoring goals. They almost never scored goals. They would pass the ball or kick the ball to the key players who would actually get all the glory. But it's even better than that. These players, these captain class players, took on the humble jobs to serve the team. So one example is Carla Overbeck. Carla Overbeck captained the US women's soccer team to win the World Cup in 1999. Even though Carla Overbeck was the captain, she would routinely carry her teammates' bags to their room in their hotel. She took on humble jobs to serve the rest of the team. And these people blitzed the world. They blitzed the world. This is what David does in this chapter. All he does is he thinks about others. He serves others. Now, part of that is he's still in charge. He's still king. He did come up with a plan to try and thwart Absalom's treason. So he purposely sends back Zadok and Abiathar and Hushai back to Jerusalem to use them as spies. Again, read forward this week and find out how that actually helps triumph over Absalom. But David's main goal here is not to grasp power for himself. It's to serve his people in any way he can. And that's what makes him a good leader. For whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Now, final question we need to ask is, how is it that David can do this? All right? If this is what makes him a great leader, in spite of his flaws, right, how does he do it? He's fleeing for his life, and all he cares about is looking after others. What is it that David knows? What is it that David has that makes him do this? Well, the answer is David knew he had a God who was serving him. David knew he had a God who was in his corner, actually serving him. And this is the thing. If we know that we have someone powerful in our corner, it makes us want to serve them. So I just so happened across a TED Talk this week. It had nothing to do with my sermon. Just came across it. It's by a guy by the name of Simon Sinek. I listen to him a lot. He's a motivational speaker, a really high-powered management consultant. And he did this TED Talk about management. He said, good managers have this one character trait about them. Right? What makes a good manager? A good manager is someone who makes their workers feel safe. Now, what does he mean by that? What he means is the workers know they're not going to be fired at their first mistake. They know their boss has their back, and their boss will train them and mentor them and care for them and help them improve. And he said, workers who know their boss has their back will bend over backwards for their boss. And friends, this is what sets biblical Christianity apart from every single other world religion. Now, every world religion has one thing in common. That is that they know our biggest problem in life is sin, and we need to deal with that in order to get a good afterlife. Every religion talks about that, all right? But the thing that splits biblical Christianity apart from every single other world religion is that every single other world religion says we deal with our problem of sin by sacrificing for God. Right? Every world religion says we need to do things to earn God's favor. We've got to do good deeds, religious works, we've got to pay penance, go on pilgrimages, go to purgatory, all right? All so that we can sacrifice for God and earn his favor. Biblical Christianity is the only world religion that says God sacrifices for us. David experienced this in 2 Samuel 7. We looked at it a couple of weeks back. Remember, David says, I want to sacrifice for you, God. I want to build you a house. And God says, no, you're not going to sacrifice for me. I'm going to sacrifice for you, and I'm going to build you a house, David. Right? David knew God was in his corner. And so when David crosses the Kidron Valley in verse 23, and when David climbs the Mount of Olives in verse 30, he's weeping, but he knows God is in his corner. And we see this in his actions, right? In verses 24 to 26, actually. Firstly, I mean, he's fleeing for his life, but he still worships God. He still offers sacrifices in verse 24. But have a look at verse 26. David says, if God is not pleased with me, then I'm ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him. What he's saying is, not my will but yours be done, O Lord. David is submitting himself to the Lord's will, whatever happens. Now, that's David. Our problem is we don't have a 2 Samuel 7 experience. God has never said to us, I want to build you a house. Or has he? Because about 900 years after the events of 2 Samuel 15, Jesus crossed the Kidron Valley and Jesus climbed the Mount of Olives one night. And that was the night Jesus said, not my will, but yours be done. Now, why did Jesus say that to his father? It was to sacrifice for us. You see, the cross proves categorically that Jesus is in our corner. I don't know if you ever stopped to think about that. The God of the universe carries our bags to our room. The Lord of hosts washes our feet. Right, friends, we have a God who sacrifices for us. And the further that sinks into our heart, the more we will be freed up to serve like David did. We won't need to grasp power for ourselves. We will just want to serve God by serving others. And so this is our application for the day. If we want to be the kind of person that God wants to use powerfully for his kingdom, it's all about character. It's all about character. But here's the thing. The way we build our Christian character is not by focusing on our Christian character. We need to focus on Christ and realize that he is in our corner. And the beauty of doing this, of focusing on the gospel, is that it actually balances out our flaws. You and I, we've got flaws, we've got weaknesses, just like David. But the more we focus on the gospel, the more those flaws get overcome. So I'll give you some examples. We might be really bad at telling people about Jesus. We've got fears, we've got fumbling, we don't know if we're saying the right thing. But here's the thing, the more we focus on Christ each and every day, the more gospel joy we get. And the more joyous we are, the more people will want to just ask us about why we are joyous. They will want to talk to us because of our joy. We might be terrible pastorally. We might have very low emotional IQ, if they call it that. But here's the thing, the more we focus on Christ, the more we understand the depths of our own sin. And you know what that does? It makes other people feel safe around us. They will open up to us because they know we're not going to look down in judgment on them, because we're happy to admit that we're in the trenches right with them, with our sin. We might be the kind of sheep that just follow the latest trends of the world. But the more we focus on Christ, the more holy we get overall. And even though we may not be natural leaders, people of influence, just pulled to and fro with whatever's going on, others will see an honesty in us, an integrity in us, and they'll actually respect us for it. Friends, the way we become a Christian who God wants to use is by making sure we're warming our hearts each and every day with Christ's love, with knowing that we have a God who is in our corner, sacrificing for us. And he does so because he wants us on his team. In spite of our flaws, friends, even though David was seriously flawed, God still used him to rescue the day. So may we follow his example. You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant.